walk into this room at your own risk. Because it leads to the future. Not a future that will be, but one that might be. This is not a new world. It is simply an extension of what began in the old one. It has refinements, technological advances.
This is Lone Wolf Radio Network, right here in the bunker. We're ready to go. Are you ready to go? Yeah, we're at, send your mail to Tom Metzger, 315. No, you don't even need to do that. Tom Metzger, P.O. Box 1687, San Jacinto, J-A-C-I-N-T-O, California 92583, and that'll get right to me. So let's get to the show.
The date is the 7th of September, 2027. Yeah, I finally got that out. I'll tell you, I've got a head cold that's from hell. So we're not going to be talking much today, but I'm going to put a show on here for you from my friends over in this Russia. Yeah, Russia TV. Crosstalk, one of my favorite shows. Let's see what you think.
Hello and welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. How bad can it get? How low can Russia-U.S. relations go? At this point, it's anyone's guess. But one thing is for sure, Donald Trump's call for better relations is now dead in the water. Crosstalking Russia-U.S. relations, I'm joined by my guest here in Moscow, Mark Sloboda. He's an international affairs and security analyst. We also have Nikolai Petro. He is a professor of political science at University of Rhode Island. And we have Dmitry Babich. He is a political analyst with Sputnik International. All right, gentlemen, Crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump in anytime you want. And I always appreciate it. Professor, let me go to you first here. Where are we in this relationship right now? We talked about this in an earlier edition of Bullhorns. What does each country want to achieve in this spiraling downward effect?
It wants to embarrass the other side.
Yeah.
That's tit for tat, and it's like two bullies in a schoolyard, I guess. They have to keep sniping at each other.
So it's a prestige issue right now.
More than anything else, particularly on the issue of the expulsion of diplomats and the closing of these diplomatic missions. The interesting question that we were talking about before before the cameras came on was the issue of rules. And are there still rules that apply? And I think what we're seeing now is the erosion of rules, which is neither the absence of rules nor clear rules. And the erosion creates a great sense of insecurity among everyone, both participating and observing, because we're seeing holes appear in predictable behavior. Right. So anything is possible now, and that's a very frightening situation.
Mark, that's a very frightening situation here, because once you abandon the rules, I mean, I think our viewers have to understand is that there's a certain kind of etiquette that is expected in diplomatic circles, and even the worst rivals respect those things. You respect the immunity of diplomats. You respect property rights here. All of this has been blown out of the water, and it is not mentioned in Western media that this is happening right now.
It hasn't been blown out of the water just recently, or only with Russia even. Look at Julian Assange, trapped in the Ecuadorian embassy in London under siege, right, for years. It's all since 1992 with the unipolar moment. The U.S. political establishment became addicted to not being adhering to the rules. The American exceptionalism says the U.S. is not bound by the rules of international law or the etiquettes of international diplomacy. And this is only the latest round of this. And also, there's other factors of the game now. I prefer to think of it as a great game.
So like
Cold
going
War,
back to the 19th century.
The 19th century that weren't ever established in rules. Cyber warfare. I mean, this is suddenly a siren klaxon coming out of the U.S. media. Oh, Russia cyber attacking. The U.S. has been cyber attacking Russia and other countries for years. That's never been reported on. There are no rules established for that. President Putin has asked repeatedly for the U.S. to sit down and negotiate rules for cyber warfare, for economic warfare, for these other things that they're not only... You know, we're talking erosion. They're talking new aspects of the game that rules were never created for.
Dima, with this latest tit for tat, is Washington trying to push the Kremlin into doing something irrational, rash, to make them overreact? Because with this environment of no rules, you can expect the unexpected. I sense that's not going to happen. There will be a reaction, but asymmetrical probably.
Well, I mean, right now we have some liberal commentators here in Russia regretting the fact that Putin did not respond in a tit for tat way immediately. And obviously these are people just interested in a deterioration of relations.
Well, if not only liberals.
Yes, I
regret it.
I agree with the professor that basically there are no rules, but I will just tell very quickly what are the rules that are absent now and that were in place during the Cold War. During the Cold War, we had an arms control regime, which is basically dead now, you know. ABM treaty was destroyed back in the early 2002. CFE, conventional forces in Europe, doesn't work anymore.
Intermediate range nuclear forces.
Yeah, you know, Russia now is going to have joint exercises with Belarus. That is seen as an excuse for dozens of exercises right on Russia's borders, in Estonia, in Romania, in Georgia, everywhere. So basically, and there is another very sinister development. The U.S. is now targeting the Russian elite. Look at the sanctions war. It says that President Trump and the U.S. government in general should produce every year a report on the big business in Russia, on the connection of Russian businessmen to the Kremlin, on the incomes of their spouses, their children, their parents, their property abroad. So now the elite is targeted. So this game is not only very dangerous and unpredictable, it is also very undemocratic.
What is the end game? What does this American onslaught, you know, starting in the end of December? I used to onslaught correctly. I mean, there was no evidence. There was no, you know, they didn't catch a spy. They didn't have any microfilm. They didn't have a hard drive that they caught. I mean, there was no evidence for this here. It was capricious, okay? Mm-hmm. And that evidence has never been shown publicly here. So I think it is very rash here. What does the U.S. want in this type of behavior, except for to embarrass and to force an overreaction, which historically is not something that comes from the Kremlin? Go ahead.
The lack of predictability leads to an inability to explain these actions rationally. But I would flip the question a little bit, and perhaps we can discuss it from this perspective. Who benefits and who loses? Which side gains more and which side loses more from a continued deterioration? Because the trajectory we see, the trajectory is downward. So who stands to gain, who stands to lose more, Russia or America? I think my immediate assessment is that Russia does not lose as much as the United States overall from a deterioration of relations. The relations are already so bad,
right.
It doesn't affect our commercial ties, it doesn't affect our diplomatic ties, because all of those and intelligence ties, those are all pretty much been suspended. But a continued deterioration of relations between these two superpowers frightens the Europeans, and it leads to a rift between the United States and Europe, and there has already been pushback on that front against a further, what the Germans call, let's not have another ice age, said the German foreign minister.
You know, Mark, one of the things I've been noticing, and this goes all the way back to the the Ukraine situation in 2014, with the rhetoric that we hear from Western politicians, I don't care what political party, and from Congress, and of course from the media, how do you walk back any of this to improve relations when it's necessary? Or are we looking at, and now maybe I'm exaggerating here, or just for the next generation, it's going to be very low level, but it's going to be a diplomatic Cold War?
Yeah, there has to be an intention to walk back.
That's what I'm getting at.
There is no such intention. And when Nikolai asks who benefits and who doesn't, he's exactly right. But we can't look at this outside of the prism anymore of U.S. domestic politics.
Agreed.
President Trump campaigned and won the election. Perhaps the only foreign policy platform that was relatively coherent and continually expressed to his own political detriment in the United States is he wanted detente, he wanted improvement in relations with Russia, and he wanted to end the pursuit of hegemony, regime change, nation building, democracy promotion, all these euphemisms around the world. So he is now effectively a hostage in the White House. Him and a very small, dwindling circle of loyalists who were with him at the beginning, during the campaign. When you say who benefits, it's not the Trump administration who benefits. They're continually victimized and demonized throughout all of this and associated with Russia, and thus both are demonized. It is about the deep state. It is about this unelected, continuing rule by bureaucrats, technocrats that continue no matter who reigns office. There was just a piece in Foreign Policy asking, can the deep state and the media survive Trump? And they tried to cast these people as paternalistic patriots,
right,
who were protecting the country and rather than assaulting democracy with leaks.
Kind of like the Holy Ghost.
Yeah, they were trying to recast their treason as patriotism. And they said they would follow and obey a reasonable president. They get to decide what is reasonable, what isn't, and anything that deserts from the U.S. establishment foreign policy
that
gets down is not
to
reasonable.
Just trust me. I don't like that phrase here. You know, Dima, let's turn it again around. Why should the Russians care? If you don't want to parlay, then you just say, okay, fine.
Well, I think the professor raised a very important issue. Who is going to lose from this? Well, I would ask the other question. Who is going to gain? I think BRICS and China in particular, they now look so much more reliable than the United States. And the main loser is the credibility of the United States. I mean, when President Trump now says, I decided to suspend the trade ties with countries that trade with North Korea, what does it mean? Is he going to suspend trade ties with China, which is $650 billion per
Germany,
year?
Germany, India,
absolutely.
Israel?
So that is a blow to the U.S. reputation, to the credibility of the U.S. foreign policy. If Russia had been such a bad country, you know, it would rejoice. But I don't think so, because
no?
Russia does not want to defeat or damage the United States. Russia wants to defeat the ideology of regime change. And that ideology is the same in the United States, in Western Europe, in Central Europe. I mean, with Julian Assange, after all, this is the U.K. that is basically keeping him hostage. With the situation
after
in Europe,
the squeeze lifted.
Absolutely,
right. There's really no cost.
There's
right.
No charges.
Right.
One
no
of
charges.
The main clients of the EU in the former Soviet Union, Ukraine, is now going to introduce legislation that would make it a criminal offense for the Ukrainian officials to visit Russia, which is like making a criminal offense for Canadians to visit the United States, you know, or even worse. So you have this ideology, which is the real enemy, not the country.
And this is your favorite card to play here.
So
gentlemen, we're going to go to a short break, and after that short break, we'll continue our discussion on Russia-U.S. relations. For All Things Are Considered, I'm Peter LaBelle. To remind you, we're discussing Russia-U.S. relations. Okay, let me go back to Nikolai. One of the things that I ended the first segment here, why should Russia really care? If the U.S. doesn't want to parlay in a bilateral relationship, then at a certain point you just say, okay, that's the way it's going to be. But we live in a real world with very real problems, and let's consider North Korea. I think that Russia has played a very constructive role in the United Nations. A lot of people didn't agree with Russia's position on voting on additional sanctions. Though when they did do that, and China did do that, they had a roadmap how to move forward, and a very reasonable one, I would say, at that.
Which has been completely ignored.
which has been, it's been ignored is an understatement, okay? I mean, most people don't even know it happened, okay? So, but this is a time when the United States and Russia really, truly need to work together and to resolve this crisis that I think that has been generated from the West. That can be a different conversation. But these are two key, for goodness sake, North Korea and Russia border each other. Okay, Russia has a vested interest in resolving this situation here. And with this tit-for-tat, this the deterioration of relations, this is the worst possible time for something like this to happen.
In the West, there seems to be an assumption that if Russia is somehow marginalized from the international equation, more decisions can be taken. The problem now is that Russia needs to be part of the international order, America needs to be part, and crucially, the relationship between the United States and Russia needs to be a has been and continues to be a fundamental cornerstone of the international order. Now, when you take that out, the international order collapses. It becomes a free-for-all.
Right.
And again, it would be interesting to consider who benefits, cui bono, who benefits from a free-for-all. Because obviously somebody must be thinking that they benefit more from the collapse of all rules and international anarchy than from any type of
arrangement. Nicola, you just said somebody might be thinking. I don't see a whole lot of thinking out there. Mark, okay, another derivative of that, if the let's say the countries of NATO and the United States, let's say even Japan, ignore Russia, take Russia out of the equation on the international stage. That doesn't stop from Russia and China resolving this issue themselves. Who becomes marginalized then?
Yes.
It cuts both ways. Go ahead.
That's why I talk about it as a great game with multiple players now, not just, although the U.S. is doing its best to push it that way. The problem when we're talking about international order is that we here and Western commentators and theorists talk about two different international orders. We talk about the post-World War II, 1945, UN Security Council, UN Charter world of international order, sovereignty, non-interference in domestic affairs. Well, they are talking a liberal world order, as they refer to it, started under Bretton Woods, the creation of the WTO and the global free trade regime, and then it came to hyperpower with the collapse of the Soviet Union, the dissolution of the Soviet, self-dissolution of the Soviet Union in 1992, and the emergence of the U.S. as a hyperpower bestriding the world. So what we're left with in North Korea in specifically is that Russia and China, neither one of them are proponents, real proponents of the regime in North Korea. They're giving, it's not a real communist, not that Russia and China are communist anymore, no matter how much Americans like to believe that they are. They certainly don't want a nuclear arms race in Northeast Asia. But Japan, South Korea looking to develop nuclear weapons, they don't want it. But they don't want North Korea to collapse unilaterally with U.S. military bases running up the North Korean peninsula and a humanitarian catastrophe.
Okay.
They want an organic dissolution of North Korea into United Korea. The U.S. will never allow that to happen on terms that would allow South Korea to emerge with its own sense of geopolitics that might draw it even a little bit closer to China and towards more historical antagonism with Japan.
But I see this as a real possibility that Russia and China could be successful in dealing with this situation, and who loses? Okay, the reputation of the United States loses, and there's a demonstration effect here. I mean, the proposals that the Chinese and the Russians have made, I think they're almost identical from what I understood from the United Nations Security Council. There is a possibility of that happening. And if we see that happening, you could see the deep state that Mark has already mentioned here, they would want to spoil that. They would want to make sure that couldn't happen, which brings us back to the same crisis that we started from. Go ahead.
The problem is that deep state never stops short of anything except complete victory and the destruction of the enemy. Basically, what does North Korea want in the first place? Talk to us. take us seriously.
A permanent peace treaty.
You used to do it, you know. The South Korean presidents met, North Korean president just a few years ago, President Kim Dae-jun, you know, the former dissident, met Kim Jong-il, and the sky didn't fall upon the earth, you know, the situation indeed improved. But this is the problem. The United States simply doesn't notice the organizations that it does not like. For example, the Eurasian Economic Union, you know, the uniting the former Soviet republics, not the Baltics, not Ukraine, but those which have normal relations with Russia. The Eurasian Economic Union exists. We already have a free trade zone with Vietnam, but the United States doesn't notice it. CSTO, Collective Security Treaty Organization of the former Soviet Republic. The United States and NATO do not notice it.
You mean don't acknowledge it?
Do not acknowledge it, and they don't even notice it in the sense that they never comment on any actions of CSTO. Even BRICS, they barely notice, you know. And this is...
Well, I think they notice it, but they don't want to respect it because it violates their sense of the world.
They don't want to legitimize.
They want to legitimize it.
Sometimes I have an impression that the United States, for the first time in many years, is ruled by anti-Hobbesians. You know, Hobbes warned us that if you don't have rules, if you don't have order, which may be cumbersome sometimes, you have a war of everyone against everyone. And this is exactly what we are having now. Mm. Well, you said a cui bono, who profits? Well, we have situations in history when wrong ideologies just created this international disorder, and it was a lose-lose situation for everyone. It destroyed millions of people, it destroyed billions of dollars in property. And, you know, it was not to anyone's benefit, except ideologies.
Okay.
But there is a profit motive. Mm-hmm. I recall one of the popular ideologists of early capitalism is Joseph Schumpeter, whose great contribution was creative destruction, that out of this total leveling of the field, new growths, new births come about.
If you want to call that a contribution.
Right. Right. And here's the danger that they're not creating a firewall. Our intellectual community in the West, it seems, is not creating a reasonable firewall between economics and politics. Because whereas in economics, at least you could argue some potential benefit coming out of the rearrangement of assets and capital, in the case of politics, you're talking about deaths.
Real deaths.
You're talking about human lives being lost and future generations being lost forever.
I'm glad the professor raised Schumpeter and his analogies, because Schumpeter wrote in one of his books about the collapse of the Roman Empire. The reason why it collapsed was it didn't recognize any legitimate opponents. They were all either terrorists, you know, the empire has no opponents, only terrorists. You know, it has no foreign opponents, only crazy regimes, barbarian regimes.
It recognizes only itself and its client states.
It recognizes only itself. So when you don't have legitimate opponents, then you collapse simply because nothing can exist without...
And before you collapse, you become increasingly irrelevant to the political order.
Right. That's the danger there.
The question repeatedly, why does Russia keep trying? Why does Russia keep trying to parlay and improve relations with Russia? It's simple. Russia is the weaker power. Russia is not the Soviet Union. Its geopolitical horizons are muchly reduced. Its ability to project power, its economic, its relative military strength are all much reduced. But where there is still the possibility of hope for Russia is in alliance, or at least partnership, with other countries like China,
because it's much
Iran,
more adroit. The Russian Federation is far more adroit than the Soviet Union was, because it was driven by ideology.
It's not driven. In fact, to a fault, it's not driven by ideology. Mm-hmm. Pragmatism and cynicism rule the Kremlin. Now, this is where the U.S. is doing us a favor in the long run. They're pushing Russia, China, Iran, and other countries, but particularly those three together, and in this attempt to isolate Russia, which is only isolating it from the West, which is no longer the whole world. And here in Russia, those of us who don't want to eventually be vassals of U.S. Western hegemony, we see this as a positive development. We want decoupling from the West.
Depending on how...
We want
this is
allegiance
a very,
with China and Iran.
The North Korean crisis could... if it's resolved, it could be resolved in a way that a lot of people don't expect.
Well, I think I'm not sure the Kremlin is run only by pragmatism. Because
well, Mark said pragmatism and cynicism. So
the reason ideology is the ideology that such different countries as Egypt and China can accept. Look at what happened during the last BRICS summit in Xiamen. China invited Egypt. Russia promised to invite Iran. Egypt and Iran are formally enemies. Absolutely. They are formally supporting different sides in Yemen. But despite all the differences, they don't want that global disorder. Right. And BRICS, despite all the odds, people say, oh, this is an organization dominated by China. 70% of trade is via China. Well, yes, but they still come up with political statements every time. And what do you read in the statements? It's always against regime change, against intervention into the internal affairs of other states. That's an ideology.
That's not ideology. That's international law.
That's ideology of international law.
30 seconds.
American soft power used to be considered the source of its strength. That soft power was based in large part on its ability to act as a peacemaker around the globe, both a peacemaker and a peace enforcer.
When?
Now, well, in the immediate aftermath, at the early stage of the Cold War.
Go ahead, keep going.
And now it is losing that crucial element, proving to be ineffective both in maintaining international peace or in being a facilitator of international peace, and that is creating space for alternative solutions.
Very good point to end on. Thank you, gentlemen. We've run out of time.
And that's the latest roundtable from Russia Today, and it's quite interesting. A lot of things are talked about on there you don't see or hear on American TV or anything else. Now let's close out the show with a little from Max Kaiser. Now I know some people have said he's Jewish, and he may be, but maybe like George Lincoln Rockwell said, he's a tame Jew. I see a lot of important information on the economy coming from him.
This is Kaiser Report. You know, Elon Musk over there at Tesla, Mark Zuckerberg at Facebook, they're all arguing about artificial intelligence. Like, is it going to destroy the world? Elon Musk says, maybe it will. Mark Zuckerberg is already destroying the world, so why does he care? Let's find out more from Stacy.
Well, Max, we are also going to talk here about trust, antitrust. You and I have discussed on our show several times the fact that we have tech monopolies starting to emerge in Silicon Valley. Now, we know that Silicon Valley is in the heart of California, which is also very democratic and liberal. So a lot of the liberal media elite like these guys, and so don't mind their monopolies, perhaps. So we're going to look at what has happened since Hillary Clinton lost the election. She lost to a reality TV star. She was humiliated by losing to a reality TV star. All of our media elite in the likes of MSNBC and CNN have demanded that their good friends in Silicon Valley, their good friends who run Facebook, their good, nice guys who run Google, and all their friends that they hang out with, that they start censoring the speech of people that they don't like. I encountered it twice in one day, just on a little stupid link I provided on my Facebook page from Boing Boing. Facebook threatened to block my page, claiming that Boing Boing link was fake news. Let's all pray for Hillary. Of course, I said let's pray for Hillary because I believe this whole charade of fake news is about protecting Hillary, making her feel better. So as you see, I got shut down from Facebook, and then I posted it to Twitter. And when I posted it to Twitter, they shut down my comments, saying, show additional replies, including those that may contain offensive content. So here you see the beginning of the shutdown of the free space that is the Internet.
Oh! Yeah. Well, you know, people think that, you know, these speech requirements on these sites have to be looked at more closely because there's bad actors, there's hate speech, and Mark Zuckerberg needs to be filtering out the triggering words and phrases that might corrupt our youth and create a political outcome like that would not be conducive to making America as much in Hillary Clinton's image as possible. And that's not really what's going on. The algorithm that is at technological heart of pulling your content from Facebook or Twitter is not dictated to some kind of corporate committee looking to better the walled garden and make speech more free and democratic. No. The algorithm is controlled by corporations and advertisers who are trying to steer you algorithmically to their products. I would imagine, since the biggest advertiser probably in the world is opiate pushers, that they're pulling your content for some reason, trying to steer you into getting hooked on opiates if you're not already on opiates. So the bigger question is a CEO like Mark Zuckerberg aware that he is the conduit from the poppy field in Afghanistan to the people dying in the streets across America vis-a-vis the algorithm dictated by advertisers that create dead people, more dead people than the dead war army of the Game of Thrones? Is he aware of it? Oh, yeah, probably. Does he care about this American opiate holocaust? Probably not.
They start censoring the speech of people that they don't like. I encountered it twice in one day just on a little stupid link I provided on my Facebook page from Boing Boing. Facebook threatened to block my page, claiming that Boing Boing link was fake news. Let's all pray for Hillary. Of course, I said let's pray for Hillary because I believe this whole charade of fake news is about protecting Hillary, making her feel better. So as you see, I got shut down from Facebook, and then I posted it to Twitter. And when I posted it to Twitter, they shut down my comments, saying, show additional replies, including those that may contain offensive content. So here you see the beginning of the shutdown of the free space that is the internet.
Oh, yeah. Well, people think that, these speech requirements on these sites have to be looked at more closely because there's bad actors, there's hate speech, and Mark Zuckerberg needs to be filtering out the triggering words and phrases that might corrupt our youth and create a political outcome like that would not be conducive to making America as much in Hillary Clinton's image as possible. And that's not really what's going on. The algorithm that is at technological heart of pulling your content from Facebook or Twitter is not dictated to some kind of corporate committee looking to better the walled garden and make speech more free and democratic. No. The algorithm is controlled by corporations and advertisers who are trying to steer you algorithmically to their products. I would imagine, since the biggest advertiser probably in the world is opiate pushers, that they're pulling your content for some reason, trying to steer you into getting hooked on opiates if you're not already on opiates. So the bigger question is a CEO like Mark Zuckerberg aware that he is the conduit from the poppy field in Afghanistan to the people dying in the streets across America vis-a-vis the algorithm dictated by advertisers that create dead people, more dead people than the dead war army of the Game of Thrones? Is he aware of it? Oh, yeah, probably. Does he care about this American opiate holocaust? Probably not.
Well, I don't want to get into drug war policy or any of that stuff, but I will mention that in terms of their competitor, marijuana would, I suppose, be a competitor to opioid advertisers on Facebook. And the story that I had linked to was underwear-clad man outside of courthouse with sign, return my bong. His name is Jeffrey Shaver. He's 31, and he's standing outside the Kitchener, Ontario courthouse wearing underwear besides two signs that read return my bong and return my marijuana because apparently they had been seized by the court. But in terms of talking about fake news, a lot of the products that are pushed on Facebook, that are pushed by the the foundations, the backing of the likes of National Public Radio, you know, the wealth of many of these companies, of the families that back these sort of industries, you know, they come from a lot of fake medical problems. Like, why is there an opioid epidemic? Well, it's because what you used to just take a patent-free aspirin, you know, to deal with the pain you have, they now give basically heroin in a fancy pharmaceutical form. But, you know, it was fake problems that originally that caused this opioid epidemic.
Right. Opioids are the new Zyklon B in America. Just devastating the population. Final solution, kill everybody. Thanks, drug companies. Make sure to pick up my check at the end of the month. You're doing a great job.
We're talking about these monopolies, the tech giants who have monopoly on our internet space, from Amazon to Google to Apple, and, you know, these big tech giants out in Silicon Valley. Now, one thing that we've seen post Hillary's humiliation is that this alt-right is being shut down. Everybody's shutting down their websites. Their Cloudflare is even blocking them from even accessing the internet. For example, the Daily Stormer, which is a neo-Nazi site. But now we have the emergence of a new thing. It's not the alt-right. It's not the alt-left. It's called alt-tech, to basically fight censorship. So the internet of hate. After Charlottesville, Nazis, white supremacists, and the alt-right have become a lot less welcome on the web, so they're building their own. First, they started with companies like Patreon, which is, you know, Patreon is a place that you can go in order to finance certain writers or podcasters or YouTubers that you like. Patreon is a place where those who are not allowed on Patreon because they're deemed by Patreon to be hate mongers. They're going to Patreon, which supports all speech, including hate speech. Then you have an app like Gab, which is a chatting app that was available, that didn't censor speech and basically then flourished amongst the alt-right community and also neo-Nazis and stuff like this. The app stores on iPhone, the Apple Store, the Android App Store, they deleted the app and wouldn't let people access this. So the guy who runs that company is called Sanduja. That's his last name. I don't know what his first name is because I haven't written it down here. But just so you know, when you hear me say Sanduja, this is the guy who runs Gab. So here they're fighting back. It would be hard not to spot the irony if one of the most significant threats to big tech's monopolistic power ends up being caused by hate groups. Gab Sanduja believes that Apple and Google shutting out his company from their app marketplaces prevents it from accessing 70 to 75% of its potential U.S. market. Even if you agree with banning Gab, the power of a handful of companies to banish anyone from the internet should give you pause. And it is one reason why the arguments of alt-tech advocates may find more and more friendly ears in Silicon Valley, where many entrepreneurs increasingly worry that they can't compete.
Somehow, Mark Zuckerberg made Nazis sympathetic. If he had told me that was going to happen a couple of years ago, I would have doubted it. Yikes!
Where does this go? You know where it ends up eventually. So here, many of these people would have liked Hillary Clinton because Hillary Clinton would have definitely looked the other way as they consolidate more and more power. So perhaps they decide that Bernie Bros, that they're hate speechers, that they're not welcome on the internet, that their posts on Facebook should have been deleted, that they should have been shadow banned. You know, so where does it end? Because is it acceptable to say that people who supported Bernie Sanders, that they could lead to a neo-Nazi sympathizing sort of president? And is it worth it then to block these people? So where does it eventually end?
Well, what Mark Zuckerberg is implying by this policy of censorship is that the American Constitution, the Bill of Rights, and 240 years of history is not sufficient enough to discourage an alternative view of humanity, let's say via Nazism. In other words, this is the most anti-American thing any one person could do, would be to impose monopoly pricing and monopoly power, discourage competition, which includes competition of ideas, to favor censorship, which is the cliche of a dictator, book burning, you know, which is what they do under dictators. So Zuckerberg is a book burning dictator who hates America and is pushing drugs. Other than that, he's got a nice wife and baby, and he seems like...
But a lot of stuff was considered hate speech at one time. Interracial marriage used to be considered almost a hate speech. The fact that you would advocate it was considered hate speech. So if you stop speech and ideas from flourishing, then, you know, it could lead to a bad place. Now, I want to quickly, in the last 2 minutes here, I want to point out that there's been another story in the past week, which is that Google has basically shut down a think tank. The headline reads, Google critic ousted from think tank funded by the tech giant. So Barry Lynn runs a bit of the New America Foundation, which is a liberal left-wing think tank out of Washington, D.C. He ran the bit that is called Open Markets. We've cited them often here on the show because they had Matt Stoller there who talked about these tech giants and the emerging monopolies and corporocracy there. So they've been shut down by Google because Eric Schmidt was very unhappy with their work that they were doing, basically calling Google an emerging monopolist. And in fact, Anne-Marie Slaughter, who runs this foundation financed by Google, she emailed Barry Lynn, who she then ousted, and said, we are in the process of trying to expand our relationship with Google on some absolutely key points, Ms. Slaughter wrote in an email to Mr. Lynn, urging him to just think, in capitals, about how you're selling funding for others.
Things like these drone operators in Boca Raton, Florida, who are operating drones in Afghanistan, weddings, getting a Purple Heart. That's Eric Schmidt. He's pushing a button, and he's stabbing the Constitution in the heart. And he should be taken up, you know, something should be done here in a serious way. But we have to go now.
I'm sorry for those dropouts in those shows. This is a problem. I'm on a system. It hasn't been reworked for 20, 30 years, and it desperately needs to be redone. But my techie and I are going to work on it this weekend, and I think we're going to get around this problem of dropouts. It seems I don't get it on normal regular TV, but I sure seem to get it on these programs like this, like from Russia Today and others, which I don't think is maybe an accident at all. But anyhow, we're going to hopefully get it straightened out this weekend, so maybe I'll be back in the saddle and not have a schnoz running like Niagara Falls by the first of the week. So that's it for today. I'll be back tomorrow, sort of.